Chapter 27. Major Espinosa laid the weather report back on Luis Loretta's desk. The small office, with its obligatory picture of Generalissimo and Ernesto Corazon on one wall, and a poster of a scantily clad girl on the other, was thick with their cigar smoke. This storm would be perfect cover for an American Special Force strike. They'll be expecting us to sit down here all snug in our bunks while they sneak around and place explosives all over the camp. He brooded for a moment. I'm going to push out the perimeter patrols another couple of miles. If they're here, they would have parachuted in well back from the coast and would need to come overland.
Surely you don't think they'll attack, Loretta said, waving his cohiba airily.
Espinosa stared at him flatly.
I am paid to be prepared if they do. I don't have the luxury of opining.
We each have our jobs, the facility director replied, thinking it was better the soldiers freeze out there than his people. There came a knock on the door. Come, Loretta bellowed. In walked Li Fong, the head of the Chinese search team. He was grinning ear to ear.
Fong, how are you? Luis greeted.
Most excellent. We found the Silent Sea.
The director came halfway out of his chair.
So soon? That's wonderful. Here, have one of my cigars.
When he sat back down, he retrieved a bottle of brandy and some paper cups from his bottom drawer.
I don't normally smoke, the soft-spoken engineer said. But under the circumstances...
Are you sure about your find?
Li pulled out his PDA and clicked through to a picture. He handed the small device to Espinosa.
After we got a solid sonar return, I sent down a camera. I admit the resolution is poor, but you are looking at the stern of one of the biggest junks ever built.
To Jorge, the picture just looked like a dark blur.
I'll have to take your word for it.
Trust me. It's the Silent Sea.
Tomorrow we will dive on the wreck and bring back irrefutable proof. I tried to report this when we were out there and have you send a boat with divers right away, but we couldn't seem to transmit.
He accepted a drink from Loretta.
Espinosa declined. I'm on duty.
Your loss. The director saluted him, then toasted Li Fong.
Congratulations. From this moment there can be no questioning our rights to this land and the riches off her coast. I've got to be honest with you guys. Ever since we started construction, I've always been afraid our operation would be discovered and we'd be booted out.
Well, no more. We are here to stay.
Have you contacted your superiors? Espinosa asked Li.
Yes, just now.
They are most pleased, he beamed. My immediate boss says I will be awarded a medal and that our company will be guaranteed a lifetime of government contracts.
Hold out for a big raise, Loretta told him, pouring more brandy into his glass.
Make them know you're worth it.
I might just do that.
Oh, I forgot. The ship on the beach.
What about it? Espinosa asked sharply. He'd been suspicious about that boat, and even seeing with his own eyes that she was a derelict didn't allay his concerns.
She's off the beach and starting to float away.
You didn't see any engine smoke?
Oh, no. And she's leaning heavily to one side. I think she will flip over soon.
Espinosa was regretting his moment of earlier charity. He should have let Sergeant Lugones lay some charges and blow her to pieces. It wasn't too late. He could ask the captain of the Guillermo Brown to sink the old scow with a missile, but he could think of no valid reason why the Navy would waste such expensive munitions on his paranoia. With any luck, the storm would either sink her or blow her so far away that he wouldn't have to worry about her presence any longer.
Mr. Loretta, might I have some more of your brandy?
It would be my pleasure.
Luis slopped some more into Lee's paper cup. The Major stood abruptly. Something wasn't right. It wasn't instinct, but the cold tickling of premonition that was setting his nerves on edge. The Americans would come. Tonight or tomorrow, when the storm picked up, and they would lay waste to what these two men were so smugly proud of. Gentlemen, I needn't remind you that until the world formally recognizes the Antarctic Peninsula as sovereign Argentine territory, we are at risk.
Come, come, my dear Major. Loretta had no head for alcohol. He was already slurring his words. There is no harm in celebrating our success.
Maybe so. But I believe you are being a little premature.
Get word to your workers that curfew tonight starts in 1 hour, and there will be no exceptions. My men are going to be on patrol with orders to shoot. Do you understand?
That sobered him up. Loretta nodded.
Curfew, 1 hour.
Yes, Major.
Espinosa turned on his heel and left the office. He'd been pushing his soldiers hard since their arrival, and tonight he'd push them harder still. By the time he and Raoul had them all deployed, there wouldn't be 1 inch of uncovered space around the oil terminal, and knowing the American proclivity for coming to the rescue of others, he would double the guard on their captives.
Juan pulled the straight razor from his neck and swirled it in the copper basin of his sink. The Oregon's steep list forced him to brace himself with his other hand. He made one more pass, rinsed the blade, and dried it very carefully on the towel. His grandfather had been a barber and had taught him that the secret of keeping a razor sharp was never to put it away wet. He pressed the plunger to drain the sink and splashed his face with palmfuls of water. He looked himself in the eye in the mirror over the vanity. He wasn't sure what he saw. He was proud of the decision he had made, yet he also thought they should have cut and run and headed for South Africa, where $5 million a week for the next 3 weeks was guaranteed for doing nothing more than babysitting a head of state who had no enemies. He dried his face with a towel and pulled on a t-shirt. They had turned up the heat somewhat, but his arms and chest were covered in goose pimples. He hopped across to his walk-in closet and selected a leg for the day's mission among the 5 artificial limbs he owned. They were lined up on the floor like a bunch of left-only cowboy boots. A few minutes later, he was finished dressing and on his way to the moon pool. He knew he should eat something, but his stomach was too knotted. The underwater operations center was a hive of activity, with teams of technicians working on the Nomad 1000 that had just returned with Trono and his group. Mike reported that the charges were planted and ready to go. His team had been drilling into the underside of the glacier, hanging over the bay and packing the holes with enough explosives to calve off 100,000 tons of ice. Juan keyed in some of the outside cameras at a workstation. The low-light cameras revealed a world gone mad. Swirling snow buffeted the ship from every direction as the wind shifted constantly. The seas heaved up waves that ran high enough to explode across the deck, and when they hit shore, they had the power to move 100-pound rocks back and forth like pebbles. He checked the meteorological display. The temperature was -12, but the wind chill brought it down to 30 below. Eddie Sang and Link showed up a couple minutes later. Because of the number of passengers they would hopefully be returning to the ship, the raiding party had to be small. The Nomad was designed for 10 people, and somehow they were going to shoehorn 21 into it. As before, they wore Arctic clothing to resemble the Argentine soldiers, and they'd packed enough extra parkas for the captive scientists into a waterproof bag strapped to the sub. Another similar bag contained the bones of the long-dead Norwegians. Juan still wasn't sure how he was going to make up for disturbing their eternal rest. Maurice appeared at Cabrillo's side bearing a serving tray. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and he looked fresh and impeccably turned out as always.
I know you rarely eat before a mission, Captain, but you need to. In these conditions, the body burns calories too fast. I don't know if I ever mentioned, but I deployed with the Royal Navy the last time the Argies became uppity in the South Atlantic. The boys who retook the South Sandwich Islands returned as stiff as Stonehenge.
He pulled off the cover and presented Juan with an omelet stuffed with ham and mushrooms. The aroma seemed to untie the knots in his belly. It also reminded him of something he'd forgotten, and he sent Maurice back to the kitchen on an errand. The launching went smoothly, and they were soon on their way. The first inkling that something had changed happened when the mini-sub passed close to the Admiral Guillermo Brown. Juan could hear over the other ambient noise that she had fired up her main engines. The sound and vibration carried through the water and echoed inside the steel pressure hull. It wouldn't alter their plan, but Juan didn't take it as a good omen. Unlike before when they had docked near the workboats, this time they surfaced at the far end of the pier, closer to where the prisoners were being held. The storm's fury overwhelmed the sound of the Nomad broaching under the dock. Link had the hatch open a moment later. He climbed from view while Juan struggled into his parka and settled his goggles. The big seal came back a moment later. "We got problems." "What's up?" "I just scoped the dock using infrared and counted 3 guards."
"On a night like this?" Eddie asked.
"Exactly because it's a night like this," Juan told him. "If I were in Espinosa's shoes, I'd plan for the storm to hide an assault and deploy my forces accordingly."
Juan took the night vision binocs from Link and did his own survey, lying flat on the pier. He saw the sentries Link had spotted, and as he scoped the rest of the base, he could see more ghostly images moving around. In 1 minute, he counted no fewer than 10 men on duty.
Change of plans.
All along, they had intended to free the prisoners and get them at least into the submersible before going after the Argentine cruiser. With so many men patrolling the facility, the chance of them being discovered was too high. Now they would use the warship as a distraction. He explained what he wanted the men to do and made sure that Max back on the Oregon was listening in.
"I don't like it," Hanley said when Juan was finished. "Not much of a choice. We won't get within 10 feet of those scientists otherwise."
"Okay. Just tell me when you're ready."
"Get as close to the jail as you can," Cabrillo told the other 2 men with him, "and wait for my signal."
They exited the submersible together, Link and Eddie each taking one of the waterproof bags in tow. They had to crawl on their bellies and move inches at a time, not to attract attention. It would take 20 minutes for them to just reach the temporary prison. Juan went in the opposite direction. The wind tore at his clothing and made each pace a struggle. It would come at his face and then reverse itself and send him staggering. His scarf drooped, and it was like his skin had been splashed with lye. He had to time his movements for when the Argentines were turned away from him. The wind did provide one thing of use. Most of the soldiers moved with their backs toward it, giving Cabrillo a chance to cover more ground when the gusts became constant. Visibility remained dismal, and he almost blundered on one soldier who stood in the lee of a bulldozer. He froze, no more than 5 feet from the sentry. The man was in profile. He was close enough to see the fur trimming around his hood whipping furiously. Juan backed a step, and then another, but froze once again when a second guard approached.
"Jaguar," the first guard called out when he saw his comrade.
"Capybara," the second responded.
These were their recognition codes. Juan smiled tightly. That was an intelligence coup. When he had cleared around the duo, he radioed that information to Eddie and Link in case they were challenged. From here on, Juan moved more swiftly, and when he came up on a guard, the man turned on him sharply, his gun not at the ready, but raised in an aggressive manner.
"Jaguar!"
"Capybara," Cabrillo said confidently. The other man lowered his machine pistol.
"The only thing that makes this worthwhile," the guard said, "is knowing that the Major is out here with us and not warm inside."
"He's never one to ask us to do something he wouldn't."
Juan had no idea if this was true, but he'd seen enough of Espinosa to think he wasn't a lead-from-the-rear kind of soldier.
"I guess." "Stay warm."
The soldier moved on. Juan kept going. 10 minutes and 3 cold and bored guards later, he reached the gas processing building.
"I'm here," he called to his men. "Where are you?"
We're still shy of our target, Link said. It's like Rio during Carnival out here. There's so many people. Max, are you ready?
Ballast is pumped clear and the engines are purring sweetly.
Okay, stand by.
Juan opened the plant's personnel door next to the giant overhead door and moved into the entry vestibule. He was challenged by a guard instantly.
Cayman!
Cabrillo swallowed.
They had different code words for when someone came into a building. He mentally cursed Jorge Espinoza's foresight as he frantically ran through the names of all the native South American animals he could remember.
Llama, boa, anaconda, sloth? From there, he drew a blank. A half-second had passed, and the sentry was about to become suspicious.
Capybara is to jaguar as what is to a caiman?
Predator and prey. Caimans eat fish. It's a fish.
Which one?
He said the only one he could think of.
Piranha.
The soldier lowered his weapon, and it took all of Cabrillo's self-control not to show his relief.
You know you aren't supposed to be in here.
Just for a second. I need to warm up a little.
Sorry, you know the Major's orders.
Come on, man. It's not like he's around right now.
The soldier thought for another second, then a look of compassion crossed his face.
All right, go ahead inside. But 5 minutes, and if Espinoza or Jimenez shows up, I'm going to tell them you've been hiding in there since before I came on duty.
5 minutes, promise.
Juan moved past the guard and walked into the overheated facility. He had to pull back his hood and unzip his parka. Machinery hummed as it processed the natural gas flowing in from the offshore pipes, while on the other side of the yawning space, the blast furnaces were hard at work keeping the bay from freezing over. Cabrillo was again amazed at the size and complexity of the Argentine facility.
Max, I'm in. Go for it.
Juan found one of the main trunk lines for incoming gas. He pulled out a small explosive and set the motion sensor. It wasn't particularly sensitive, but for what was coming, it didn't need to be. He turned to go just as 4 men entered from the vestibule. They had removed their Arctic coats, and at once Cabrillo recognized Major Espinoza. With him was the sergeant who'd been aboard the Oregon and 2 other NCOs. Juan moved behind a piece of machinery before they spotted him.
We saw you come in here, Espinoza shouted above the industrial din. Don't make it harder on yourself. Come out now and I won't charge you with desertion.
Cabrillo looked at the bomb, then back at the burly soldiers staying by the door while Espinoza and Sergeant Lugones started fanning out to find him.
Max, he whispered urgently. I might be blown, but don't stop. You read? I'll get out somehow.
Roger, Max said tersely, knowing full well that the chairman was lying about the last part. Hanley stared into space for a moment and then forced himself into action.
Mr. Stone, bring us up to 5% and set some tension on the cable, if you please.
Aye.
Eric dialed up the Oregon's unrivaled engines and moved her forward at a quarter knot. A tech stationed in the fantail locker where the cable drum was located called out when the line started showing stress. Even with wind and waves pummeling the ship, Eric didn't need to be told when she was pulling against her tether. He knew how she responded in almost any circumstance.
"Tension on, Mr. Hanley," he said with customary op center formality when a mission was underway.
"Okay. Steady acceleration. 100 feet per minute. Don't jerk the thing, lad."
"Aye, sir."
A mile astern of them, the cable looped around the pier and back to the bow of the Admiral Brown became as rigid as a steel girder when the magnetohydrodynamics encountered the cruiser's dead weight. The forces in play were massive. Imperceptibly at first, the big cruiser started to move, but not so much that her crew thought it was anything other than a swing of the wind pushing against her stern. 1 foot became 2, then 10, and then she came up hard against her anchor.
Eric kept piling on more power, causing the Oregon's stern to dig deep as water rocketed through her drive tubes. But the stubborn linchpin that Juan had so carefully sabotaged refused to give that last fraction of an inch. One of his welds holding a pad eye popped, increasing the strain on those remaining. The Oregon pulled harder still, and a second pad eye popped off the hull, leaving only six. Metal ground against metal as the stubborn anchor pin struggled to do its job. It released, and the energy stored in the carbon fiber during that frantic tug-of-war was suddenly discharged. The Admiral Guillermo Brown went from a virtual standstill to 6 knots, fast enough to knock crewmen to their knees. The captain happened to be on the bridge at this early hour, and he looked up from the report he was perusing. He knew immediately what had happened, while his less experienced crew looked confused.
"Good God! The anchor chain snapped! Helm, give me power! All back 1/3!"
"All back 1/3, aye." With a pair of gas turbine engines capable of a combined 20,000 shaft horsepower, he felt confident he could best whatever wind was thrown at him. But when he checked the gauge of their speed over the bottom, it wasn't slowing, but rather accelerating.
"Helm, all back 1/2! Quickly, man!"
The dock was only a half mile away, and it looked as though they were headed toward one of the processing plants. In seconds, he realized that the wind was stronger than anything he'd ever experienced.
"Full power!"
The Oregon could handle the cruiser's 20,000 horses without breaking a sweat. Eric had them up to 80% and noted with satisfaction that they were now pulling the Admiral Brown at 16 knots. Over the distance and the storm, he could hear a klaxon begin to scream out a collision warning. The cruiser was as helpless as an unmasted schooner as she arrowed straight for the gas plant. Her captain was at a loss to explain it. He'd ordered left full rudder to shear them away from a direct collision, and the boat responded by simply crabbing sideways in the wind. Fate or destiny was going to slam her where she wanted to go, and to him it seemed the desires of man counted for nothing. A moment before impact, he looked again at their speed over the bottom, and was aghast at how wind could push his warship at almost 20 knots. For Cabrillo, there was no time for subtlety. Whatever happened in this building and the evidence it left behind would be incinerated when the Admiral Brown came barreling through the front wall. He deftly fitted a silencer on his FN-57 and waited until Espinosa and the sergeant were out of view. He used the tangle of pipes as cover and crossed closer to the door. The two guards were on the constant lookout, their eyes never at rest, but the massive hangar-sized space was poorly lit, and Juan had more than ample cover. He kept looking back to make sure the others hadn't inadvertently flanked him. He was lining up to take his shot when a pressure release valve directly behind him hissed out a jet of steam into the air. The guards both looked in his direction, and one of them must have spotted him because his gun came up and he loosed a 3-round burst. How the spray of rounds didn't puncture a critical valve and immolate them all was a miracle. Juan ducked but came up almost instantly and dropped one of them with a double tap to the chest. The sentry who had let Cabrillo into the building burst through the door, his weapon held high and tight against his shoulder. The second guard had dived flat behind a clutch of 55-gallon drums. Cabrillo fired twice more, and the sentry collapsed. The doors closed behind him. In the distance, he could hear Espinosa barking orders. The guard peered out from around the barrels. Juan put a round 2 inches from his eye to keep him pinned in place and then charged with everything he had. The distance was less than 20 feet. He reached the barrels and jumped up in one easy bound. The guard was still flat on his stomach, never hearing the assault or expecting it. Juan's mistake was assuming that because liquid poured from the side of the barrel where the high-velocity round had punctured it, all the kegs would be full. They weren't. His foot touched down on the lid of one of the barrels, and his momentum toppled it, and the three right next to it. He fell in the middle of the clanging mess, and for a second had no idea what happened. The guard came to his wits an instant quicker. He got to his knees and swung his machine pistol toward Cabrillo. Like a greenhorn, Juan had dropped his pistol when he landed, so he kicked out with one foot and pushed one of the barrels into the guard, fouling his aim.
his three-round burst pinged off the I-beam rafters. Cabrillo grabbed the empty barrel in a bear hug and threw himself at the guard. When they collided, the soldier went down, and Juan used his impetus to drive his full weight, plus the barrel, into the man's chest. Ribs snapped like twigs. The man was down, but not out. Juan frantically searched for his automatic and was bending to retrieve it from between two more barrels when the wall behind him was stitched with a string of 9mm holes. Espinosa recognized him immediately. His eyes went wide and then narrowed with satisfaction when he realized that man who had caused him so much difficulty and shame was 20 feet from him and unarmed. "I know you are alone," he said. Sergeant Lugones appeared at his side. "Sergeant, if he moves a muscle, shoot him dead." Espinosa set his machine pistol onto an electrical transformer housing and pulled his sidearm from its holster and placed it beside it. He came up to Juan with a smug look, the look of a bully who had cornered the weakest neighborhood kid. He didn't stop even when a nautical horn sounded an alarm outside. "I don't know who you are or where you came from, but I assure you that your death is going to be especially enjoyable." Juan fired off a lightning right jab that caught Espinosa square in the nose and rocked him back a pace. "You talk too much." The Argentine charged in a blind rage. Cabrillo let him come, and as they were about to collide chest to chest, he turned to the side and shoved Espinosa in the back as he went past. He crashed into the wall hard enough to make the metal ring. "And you fight like a girl," Juan taunted. "Lugones, shoot him in the foot." The sergeant didn't hesitate. The single shot was especially loud, and Juan went down hard, clutching at the ruined member and screaming in agony. "Okay. Now let's see how you fight," Espinosa sneered. "On your feet, or the next shot takes out a knee." Juan tried twice to stand on his own, and both times he collapsed back onto the cement floor. "Not so tough now, is he, Sergeant?"
"No, sir."
Espinosa moved to Juan's side and yanked him to his feet in a savage thrust. Cabrillo swayed drunkenly and fought to keep from crying out. Espinosa kept one hand on Juan's arm and fired two powerful punches into his gut. Juan sagged and nearly dragged the Argentine down to the floor with him. "Pathetic," Espinosa said. He reached down again for a repeat performance. Juan sat meekly until Espinosa's head was a foot away. Then he reached out with both hands, one on the man's chin, the other on the occipital bulge at the back of his skull. From a disadvantaged position on the ground, he still managed to generate enough torque that when he twisted Espinosa's head, the spinal column snapped cleanly. The corpse went rubbery as it fell and nearly blocked him from picking up the 5.7. He raised it and fired before Sergeant Lugones's brain had processed what had just happened. The first round blew through his stomach and emerged on the other side. The second caught him in the forehead. The horn sounded again, one long, continuous blast of sound that originated not 50 feet from where Juan sat. He managed to get to his feet, his prosthetic leg undamaged by the bullet, and he'd started for the door when a titanic crash seemed to rock the building's foundation, and the knife-edged prow of the battlecruiser Guillermo Brown exploded through the wall of the processing plant. 6 seconds later, the shock waves generated by collapsing steel and crushed concrete was enough to detonate the bomb. The building started to go up, like the Hindenburg over Lakehurst.